In fact, short of genocide itself, I cannot think of a single one of their human rights as a people that has not been violated with a kind of refined viciousness designed to dehumanize, break their spirit, and humiliate them to a degree that is, even to someone who has been carefully but helplessly aware of this taking place, simply stupefying. And that George Bush and Colin Powell and Donald Rumsfeld should go on and on about the infractions of Saddam Hussein's regime and how he has abused human rights and flouted the regulations and resolutions of the United Nations, every one of those claims can be made against Israel in its treatment of the Palestinians.
You're listening to Edward Said, Palestine, Memory, Inequality, and Power. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
What's made it worse is how much of this has been willfully shielded from witnessing eyes by propaganda about fighting for survival against terrorism, claims that in any other instance would defy the credulity of the most gullible intelligence. The sheer inequality between the average Palestinian and the average Israeli is breathtaking. Well, you'll say something disapproving about those terrible suicide bombers, and I will agree. But I will also then ask you, how many Israelis have had to live through the demolition by bulldozing of entire villages, blocks of flats, shopping districts? How many have had to endure missile attacks by Apache helicopter or rockets from American-made F-16 fighter jets? How many Israelis have to be stripped and searched the way Palestinians are at checkpoints on an hourly basis? Neither Indians demonstrating against the British nor South African blacks fighting against apartheid faced anything like this. Nor, for that matter, did they have to reckon with missiles, hundreds of tanks, helicopters, and jets, and rocket attacks fired into civilian areas as well as refugee camps with no defenses. Consider that on the internet for January the 23rd, one can read, and I picked this at random, one can read that 836 Muslim pilgrims to Mecca from Gaza were denied permission to leave. A Palestinian Catholic cardinal was detained and prevented from leaving Tel Aviv airport. Some towns on the West Bank have already sustained 214 days of curfew. That same day, 150 dunams of fertile agricultural land were razed in Gaza. On the same day, three people, two of them civilians, were killed and six homes demolished. On the same day, 62 shops in the village of Nazlat Isa were flattened to the ground. And on the same day, literally thousands of people, many of them sick and aged men and women, children trying to get to school, doctors hoping to reach their patients and their hospitals, professors and undergraduates desperate to get to their classes, with three universities closed. I've never seen in the American university a word said in all talk about academic freedom, never a movement or a statement said about Palestinian freedom of education. Universities and schools have been closed systematically for the past 35 years, and urge your decency to put up a petition talking about academic freedom. Three universities closed and ordinary human beings shopping, looking for food or work, all of these detained every single day by the endless number of checkpoints, over 300 of them, that punctuate the existence of Palestinians in the occupied territories. 3 days ago, 12 Palestinians were killed, dozens more injured, tens of houses demolished. In varying degrees of severity and brutality, this sort of thing has been going on there every day for 35 years, as in the meantime, dozens and dozens of new settlements have been set up on Palestinian land, and 400,000 settlers are on Palestinian territory today. They crowd nearly every available hilltop. Conversely, ask the question, how many Palestinian settlements have been infringed on Israeli property? How many daily armed incursions, sometimes with 60 tanks at a time, have penetrated Israeli towns and villages? How many Israeli fields have been burned? For this kind of brutalizing assault, the United States and Israel designed what they called a peace process that lasted 10 years, which was not even supposed to put a stop to this, but rather to make it seem slightly less unbearable. Yes, a peace process requiring thousands of hours of negotiations to make Israel stop, which of course it didn't. You have to use your memory to keep in mind that since the current intifada began 2.5 years ago, representations of all this have been available on the international media, but they simply do not render anything like the harsh awfulness of what life is like for a Palestinian on a daily basis. Tim Llewellyn, a well-respected veteran BBC reporter, has recently shown that when one deplorable Palestinian suicide bombing in December took place, it was reported, he says, as if it were, and I quote him here, the beginning of a new cycle of violence, end of quote. Whereas the fact that 75 Palestinians had been killed in the preceding month, 14 of them children under the age of 18, simply went unmentioned, as did the fact of military occupation and resistance to it. The efforts of Israel's spin doctors, Llewellyn says, the U.S. government and media, in conjunction with a weak Arab communications operation, have usually combined to make Israel's broad version of events prevail. These continue to give the impression of a struggle between equal forces, a beleaguered and misunderstood Israel, occasionally forced into excessive measures to clamp down on terror, versus hordes of recalcitrant Palestinians careless of Western values and endemically suicidal for obscure religious reasons. Equivalence, he says, is at the heart of Britain's misreporting of the crisis, a charge that can be doubled and redoubled for American misreporting. Making the astonishing illegality and inhumanity of Israel's policy of Palestinian immiseration even more difficult to recall or actually see, not only for outsiders, so to speak, but even for Israelis themselves, is that, as Amir Ahas, admirable reporter who lives on the West Bank, writes in Haaretz on January the 22nd, I quote, "A person could travel the length and breadth of the West Bank without ever knowing not only the names of the villages and cities whose lands were confiscated to build the Jewish settlements and neighborhoods, but even the fact that they exist. Most of their names cannot be found on the road signs. And from a distance, the calls of the muezzins in the streets empty of people. After all, there's nothing for them to go out to, and if they wanted to, they couldn't because of the curfew. The streets, the empty of people, seem like an aesthetic decoration. A Jew traveling on the almost empty roads of the West Bank would think that there are no longer any Arabs. They do not travel on the wide roads used by Jews." End of quote. Both Ehud Barak and now Ariel Sharon have pressed ahead with the building of a fantastically expensive wall, most of it paid for by American taxpayers, which, quite apart from destroying more Arab land and separating towns from their farms on a vast scale, is designed, in fact, to blot out the existence of the Palestinians. This is what is meant, in effect, by separation, a kind of a hallucinatory delusion by which an entire people is removed from sight. Several members of the Israeli government speak without the slightest embarrassment about removing all the Arabs, as if, as they are insultingly called, from the West Bank, Gaza, and even Israel, as if those millions of Palestine's native inhabitants were so many insects to be swatted aside, out of sight and out of mind. All of this has gone on with the full support, now amounting to over $135 billion of the United States and us, its passive taxpayers. This tremendous assault on memory, to say nothing about current reality and human decency, is quite without precedent or analogy in our postmodern times. Not in former Yugoslavia, nor in Africa, nor elsewhere in Asia and Australia. By contrast, I would want to remark that all these efforts on such a scale have not achieved their goal. In every possible way, the diverse affirmations of Palestinian identity, far from being a negative or passive thing, have grown first and foremost a culture of human rights and democratic process at the grassroots level that has included a sensitive register of the claims of memory, the demand for attention and justice despite the world's indifference, and a healthy awareness of the ironies of unequal power. The other fact I'd like to note here is that even though in the US and parts of Western Europe, the notion of Palestine is associated invidiously with violence and terror, there is, as I said earlier, a serious contradiction to that superficial association in an ongoing and recognized Palestinian national life, which has a quite peculiar, if not outright, tenacity to it that has simply overcome most of the terrible ordeals placed in its path. There is today a Palestinian cinema. There's a Palestinian literature, a Palestinian political, legal, and scholarly discourse, a Palestinian theater, a Palestinian oral tradition, a large number of Palestinian grassroots organizations all over the world. In short, a Palestinian style that invigorates and informs all aspects of this far-flung community's existence. The main thing about it, to say again, is that it is quite irreversible and is fully an organic part of the universal debate on human rights, injustice, and the narrative of human freedom. Moreover, it is situated in contemporary awareness in all sorts of interesting and noteworthy ways. The habit of considering everything about Palestinian identity as at bottom being anti-Israel and only anti-Israel does an extreme disservice to the richness of the achievement I've been discussing here. As Rashid Khaldi has pointed out in his book, Palestine and the Palestinians, there was a coherent Palestinian national life well before the onset of Zionism, which despite the crisis of 1948 and the years of dispossession, has never really been broken. Moreover, the universality of the drive for Palestinian self-determination has acquired an unbudgeable place in the world's agenda for liberation, peace, sustainability, and resistance. Every major United Nations conference for the past two decades, whether concerning the place of women, the environment, racism, human rights, disarmament, health, and human development, has had an important place in it for the question of Palestine. Paradoxical though it may seem, the Davos meetings in Switzerland for governmental and corporate leaders had an important component of its agenda devoted to Palestine. While at the other end of the world, in Porto Alegre in Brazil, the anti-globalization meetings featured the presence there of a large Palestinian contingent whose attendance assured an additional progressive dimension to the debates there. Any discussion of Middle East peace, including peace in Iraq, turns out inevitably to take us back to the question of Palestine. If in the period after 1948, as part of the post-war re-emergence of Europe, Israel had the status of a progressive cause, it is now Palestine that is the progressive cause. One need only think of the support. One need only think of the support Israel had in the post-war period from such people as Sartre and de Beauvoir to judge how far from that position it has today fallen. As some of its homegrown critics like Amos Ilon and Avishai Margalit have noted sadly, that since the first Intifada of 1987, Israel has been transformed dramatically into a symbol of oppression and injustice, lumped together with the United States for its imperial arrogance, its supremacist attitudes, and for its inhumane policies towards the Palestinians over which it has ruled for so long. Divestment campaigns, reminiscent of the anti-apartheid movement of the 70s and 80s, are now an important item on American campuses. And in Europe, numerous academics and intellectuals, artists and writers discuss boycotts of Israel that were unthinkable a mere 20 years ago. Problematic and humanly a very compelling issue, the challenge posed to conscience and consciousness by the Palestinian people raises a whole raft of questions about the post-Cold War political order that are quite unique in their density and difficulty. Contentious and noisy though some of these may be, I want to bring this lecture to a close by looking at three of them as dispassionately as I can. I won't minimize my partisanship at all, but I also won't let it get in the way of as universalizing an appreciation of the issues as I can. If it is true, as I firmly believe, that the cause of Palestine and of Palestinian human rights in particular is one of the great idealizing symbols of our time, it is just as true that its bristling complexity is partly what makes it so. There are at least three very difficult, very thorny problems that I want to look at now, not from the viewpoint of a policy expert, which I'm not, offering solutions and pragmatic answers, but rather from the perspective that I can bring, that of a humanist and intellectual who is profoundly engaged in the matter, but who is independent, and I would like to think as free as it's practically possible to be of doctrinal or ideological blinkers. Take the matter of victimhood as a start. For a Palestinian like myself, who has had the most fortunate and the most luxurious of lives compared with the overwhelming number of my refugee compatriots, or those who've had to live under Israeli rule for decades and decades, it is still difficult for me to minimize how much more Palestinians have been sinned against than as a whole they have sinned, how much they have suffered terribly in an unacknowledged silence even today. As of this moment, not a single major Israeli political or intellectual figure has articulated any serious regret or contrition, to say nothing of accepting responsibility for the disasters and sustained human suffering of the Palestinian people. I know nothing at all like it in contemporary history, nothing at all quite like this amazing stone wall of obduracy and denial. And yet, I must also say that the legacy of persecution, genocide, and anti-Semitism that is so much a part of Israel's history is a background to be figured in and contended with by Palestinians just the same. Two communities of suffering, I've called them. But one must, I think, make clear that at the present time, only one community has a tremendous balance of power in its favor. The other is, so to speak, the victim of the former victim. Israeli policies, as well as the meditations of many Western liberals who feel a collective guilt for Christian and European anti-Semitism, nevertheless, must be able to disentangle the past from the present, to make very clear distinctions. To make very clear distinctions between respecting the appalling past injustices heaped on Jews historically on the one hand, and on the other, simply excusing what the state of the Jews has done to the entire Palestinian people ever since. There is simply no earthly or divine dispensation that would excuse a state or a people for wreaking havoc upon another while pleading the travails of its own past as an excuse. Sharon's ideas are at least clear in that he believes, like George Bush, that his people owns the land and the world for historical, biblical reasons, and that in making every effort to appropriate all of it at present and retrospectively, Israel is neither bound nor restrained by ordinary conventions of proper justice and proportionality. And there are many Israelis, individuals and NGOs, groups, associations that have tried to fight this. My argument here has been to say that such claims of unrestrained behavior, as Sharon says, we can do anything we like, nobody's entitled to criticize us. My argument has been to say that such claims do not at all correspond with universalism or the idea that human rights cannot be manipulated to accommodate what is a record of patent brutality and cruelty. Palestinians have been displaced, they have had their society shattered, they have had to live under military occupation, their lands and lives today are systematically torn apart. There are no two ways about it, I believe, which is not to say that we must simply overlook the tragic history of the Jews. On the contrary, I would always want to say that as a Palestinian, I should make my case to defenders of Israel on the basis of, and taking full account of, and making due acknowledgement of the history of discrimination against Jews. That kind of policy should never, ever be visited on anyone for any reason at all, least of all by Jews in the name of their safety and independence. The second problem is the one concerning the clash between two different peoples, two different cultures. Cultures, peoples, and civilizations are not watertight, inert, unchanging things. Exactly the opposite is true. And if there is such a thing as culture or nationhood at all, it is that each is and always will be enmeshed, constantly interacting and intertwined with other cultures and nations. Allowing for differences in kind, countries and peoples cannot really be separate and stand apart from their environment. It was historically one of the failures of British imperialism that in the Indian subcontinent, in Palestine, in Cyprus, in Africa, and even in Ireland, that it adopted the practice of partition, or as it has been called, divide and quit, thereby leaving matters worse off than before separation. Building walls, therefore, are a kind of folly that ought to be exposed exactly for what they are, namely a delusion that neither can be made fully to work in theory or in practice. Ignorance of the other is not a strategy for survival. All nationalisms, at their most feverish and embattled, fail this crucial test of awareness, a failure by no means limited to so-called underdeveloped or fanatical ideologies, cultures, or religions. Historically, Palestine is a palimpsest of an enormous number of peoples and civilizations, each of them leaving traces and effects that have lasted for many centuries. It must be said again and again that everything we know about ancient Palestine, for instance, speaks to a rich multiplicity of peoples and tribes, not just of Israelites, but of Canaanites, Philistines, Jebusites, Moabites, and many others. To extrapolate from that and say only one people, that only one people dominated and is therefore entitled to lay exclusive claim to Palestine today, that is simply a tragic misinterpretation and betrayal of something far richer and interesting. One can therefore interpret that history inclusively, giving rise to complexity and universalism, or far more narrowly as the exclusive possession of only one people and culture who prefer unending war against others to mutual recognition and coexistence. Civil wars are much more bitter and unyielding than any other kind. I think that's the essence of the problem we face today, namely whether, as some believe, Palestine ought to become and thereafter remain the principal homeland of just one dominant people, or whether it can become the homeland of the people who actually live there, regardless of race and religion, even though for the time being they are locked in mortal combat. I don't have an answer to the best solution, but I do think that the way things are going now, this opposition, this deep antagonistic adversarial relationship, is infinitely worse than what I and many others have tried to struggle for, the notion of coexistence and equality between two peoples who appear now to be locked in mortal combat. The final point I'd like to mention is the antithesis between present bitter antagonism and future reconciliation. Antagonism is the structure that today binds Palestinians with Israelis in the land and in the diaspora. Neither people has been blessed with a Mandela, nor even a de Klerk. We are very far from having a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The number of visionaries who have articulated thoughts that go beyond a wretched, impoverished opposition is tiny, if they exist at all. Yes, there have been Israelis and Palestinians who have tried together to work against injustice and intolerance, but they are a minority. But that need not always be so. I, for one, am full of optimism, despite the darkening sky and the seemingly hopeless situation for the time being that encloses us all. Thank you.
You were just listening to Edward Said, Palestine, Memory, Inequality, and Power. He spoke at UCLA on February 25th, 2003. Edward Said, an internationally renowned Columbia University professor, practically invented the field of postcolonial studies. This classic recording, never before broadcast, marks the 30th anniversary of the Oslo Accords and the 20th anniversary of Edward Said's death. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Medea Benjamin, Rashid Khalidi, Ilan Pape, Noam Chomsky, Amy Goodman, and Chris Hedges. And we have a series of programs featuring Edward Said. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Edward Said, Palestine, Memory, Inequality, and Power, and for his two books, Pen and the Sword, and Culture and Resistance, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with the El Fanoun Palestinian Ensemble singing Chiming Bracelets.
Yeah.